Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Those who do not learn history are doomed to repeat it.
You know, one of the things that I find both useful as a historian, but also it's a kind of a burden of being a historian, is that when things happen, you can tell when it happened before and before and before.
That's El Paso historian Yolanda Chavez Leyva speaking days after a white man drove over 600 miles to El Paso to kill Mexicans. Hateful language directed at people of color has a long, dirty history in the U.S. and along the border. Mexicans and Mexican Texans living along the border in the 1800s were frequently described as greasers, monsters, demons, bandits, criminals, not just by Anglo-Americans newly settled on the border, but by journalists who were telling faraway readers about the supposed lawlessness and backwardness of the borderlands. Just being Mexican could get you killed. That's a fear many Hispanics have today, especially after El Paso. Historian Omar Valerio Jimenez writes about how these stereotypes impacted the residents of the Texas Rio Grande Valley during Spanish colonization, Mexican independence, Texas independence, and U.S. statehood. His book is River of Hope, Forging Identity and Nation in the Rio Grande Borderlands. Valerio Jimenez is a native of the border, born in Matamoros, across from Brownsville. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Valerio Jimenez says anti-Mexican rhetoric directly affected his family's immigration story.
My dad was actually born in Texas. My grandparents and my dad left Texas during the Great Depression, and they left it precisely because of anti-Mexican violence. There's a story, a collective memory in my family of how my paternal grandmother decided that we're not sure if they witnessed it or she just heard about this lynching of a young boy, of a Mexican boy, in the Bastrop area where they were living. And during the Great Depression, she decided, you know, there was lots of anti-Mexican rhetoric and violence going on at the time. She decided, I don't want my children growing up here. And so she persuaded my grandfather to go back to Mexico. My dad still speaks about how tragic it was because he really liked being in Texas and going to school. And as soon as he got back to Mexico, he went to school for a few years and then he had to drop out to help his family because, you know, things were much harder. So that was sort of a political use of the border, right? To obtain asylum in a way, to obtain safety from persecution. Socially, we used it, right? Going back and forth to visit friends and family. And then economically, my dad, since he was a U.S. citizen, he started coming to the U.S. to work. And we still lived in Matamoros. And eventually, my mom and dad decided, why are we doing this? Why don't we just all move to Texas? And so we did, right? So these social, economic, and political reasons for crossing the border have existed since the border was created in the 19th century.
I think it's interesting, you know, as a historian, we have centuries of history behind us. And a lot of people might think, well, you know, history's already been written. You know, we have this one tale of Texas history that we're all taught in school. But as we're hearing today, now that we're hearing more Mexican-American history in books, in classrooms, on television, you're just going through a hallway and doors are just constantly opening on these new stories. I mean, are there new things that you discover on the focus that you're studying? Because as a historian, you're constantly discovering new things. Mm-hmm. So what is it that you are constantly finding new about focusing on the past?
So one of the things that historians do is we read primary sources, we read documents from the past. So this idea that history has already been written, and it has, but many times the history that's been written doesn't include everyone, doesn't include women, whether white women or Mexican women or women of color, African-American women. It doesn't include people of color, and it doesn't include, for instance, children, right? Because most of the time, the first history that's written, it's about the politicians, it's about the political leaders, it's about the business leaders. And that's important. We need to sort of know the general outlines of what happened, but that doesn't mean that it's all of history. And so when you focus on particular populations like Mexican-Americans or African-Americans or children or women, you see a different side of history. Just like when there's an accident or something and you have multiple perspectives, no one's going to agree. my sort of my next project, my third book, is going to be about this issue that I had no idea existed, because even though, like I said, I lived in Texas for a long time, I was educated here, I never knew this. It's a reference to José T. Canales. So I was doing some research for my second book, and while I was doing that, I ran across these documents, these exchange of letters between Canales and a historian at the time whose name was Carlos Castañeda. He was a historian of Spanish colonial Texas. And there was an exchange of letters. And in this exchange of letters, they write about how both of them want to make sure that Texas history includes a description of how Tejanos fought on the Texas side. So while they were doing this, Canales writes a letter saying, "I assure you, doctor," speaking to Castañeda, "that within 5 years, a new version of Texas history will be written that will include Tejano participation in the revolution." And one of the things I realize is they're all very interested in revising history textbooks used in public schools, because all of them have attended public schools in Texas. And I thought that was fascinating when I ran across it, because there's been this recent sort of controversy over textbooks in Texas, right? And whether or not they include African Americans, whether or not they include Mexican Texans, and so forth. Now there's this ethnic studies requirement that is allowed to teach ethnic studies with relation to Mexican American studies in public high schools. But that has been going on since the 1930s and probably before. And I just thought that was fascinating. When we study history, we look and we think that some of the problems that we're facing today as a society might be new because we don't know that history. But then we study history and we realize, oh, this has a very long history. And I mean, another one, for example, that I'll just quickly mention that's also pertinent to today is this idea of establishing a border wall, right? The border along the U.S.-Mexico border has been permeable since its creation, and it continues to be permeable, and it will always be permeable, just like other borders across the world. Borders are meant to contain people and goods, but it's very hard for governments to do that, to exercise that kind of control. If you ask residents along the border, many of them are opposed to the creation of the border wall because they know that it's ineffective. It's a way of getting votes, but they don't work. There's always a way around it to smuggle in goods or to smuggle in people. But, you know, it gets votes. And so there's this current discussion about constructing more and more of a border wall. The U.S. government is trying to accomplish a certain goal of creating a border wall, right? And they're discounting the opinions of people who actually live on the border. And that also has been going on since the 19th century, that their national representatives in Mexico City or in Washington, D.C., were trying to institute policies that just wouldn't work along the border because those people who were making the laws didn't live along the border. And so I thought this is also an interesting case of sort of regional interest, people along the border knowing what's for them and for both sides of the border, and national politicians ignoring that knowledge, and many times not knowing anything about the border and trying to institute policy, trying to pass laws that impact the border.
And again, this makes me think again when you wrote in your book about the journalists who were writing about the border back in the 1800s to the readers who were living along the mm-hmm. East Coast, painting this picture of what life was like, mm-hmm. supposedly. And again, it's the same. People who have not grown up along the border, as you and I have, or have lived in proximity to the border, as we are here in San Antonio, they really don't know mm-hmm. what life is like here. They only see the footage of the smugglers who are crossing the border, right. or of the migrants who are showing up by the hundreds to mm-hmm. try to cross at a particular point to give themselves up to Border Patrol agents. That's the only image people have of the border. They don't see, as you were saying, the permeability, the social life, the economic ties mm-hmm. between the two nations.
Right. And I think one of the things that I think is heartening for me is that when students do learn about this, or when the public does learn about this, they take an interest because they realize, like just like I did as a young student, oh, I didn't know that. And I'm going to try to find out more about this history. And so I think it's important for me as a professor to tell students, you know, just because you didn't know, you learned this history doesn't mean that it's too late to learn it now. You know, you can learn it now and you can learn a new aspect of what happened. So, for example, you know, one of the things that I found out, too, in my book that we haven't discussed, but that I thought was just fascinating was that when the U.S.-Mexico War occurs, the U.S. takes over and U.S. law, as I mentioned, is instituted. And U.S. law is very different than Mexican law in the mid-19th century. And so one of the ways that it's very different in regards to marriage, and so people in Mexico had to get married through the Catholic Church. And because the Catholic Church governed marriage in Mexico, it didn't allow divorce the way we know it today. It allowed for something called legal separations, but the couple was still married. They could just live apart. In the U.S., on the other hand, marriage and divorce were governed by civil laws. And so you didn't have to get married in a church. And actually, civil authorities had ultimate control over marriage. And that's why even today you still hear ministers or priests saying, by the power vested in me by the state of Texas, right? Because the state of Texas is really the one who's marrying you, not the church, not the official. So in the 19th century, you have people getting married through the Catholic Church, through the Methodist Church, but also by county judges or a justice of the peace. But you also have, what's really interesting, is you have divorces. And not only are Anglo-Texan women getting divorced, but Mexican-Texan women are getting divorced. Tejanas are getting divorced. And they're getting divorced in great numbers. And so one of the things that I found was sort of a unexpected result of U.S. conquest of the U.S. Southwest is that it opens up the avenue for divorce for women, because women are taking advantage of divorce more than men in the 19th century. Not only can they get divorced, they can get divorced through the civil courts, they can get remarried. I actually found cases of women and men getting divorced in the morning and getting remarried in the afternoon because they already knew who they were marrying, right? So U.S. annexation had a lot of negative effects for the Mexican population throughout the U.S. Southwest, right? They lost socioeconomic and political rights and statuses and so forth. But at least in one instance, women and men got access to divorce.
Omar Valerio Jimenez is an associate professor of history at the University of Texas at San Antonio. We're talking about his book, River of Hope, Forging Identity and Nation in the Rio Grande Borderlands. When we come back, border sister cities dot the Rio Grande Valley, and they all resulted from the U.S.-Mexico War.
And as soon as the war is over, all of a sudden you have the development of what we call twin cities. So Matamoros is paired with Brownsville, which is the new town, Laredo, and Nuevo Laredo. So Nuevo Laredo is in Mexico, right? And it's the new Laredo because Laredo, Texas, was the old one, was the original town.
More with Omar Valerio Jimenez coming up next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. A brand new border separated the nations of Mexico and the U.S. in 1848. It was a border that was literally fluid. People have crossed the Rio Grande to visit family, to find work, to smuggle goods, since the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo cemented the Rio Grande as the Texas-Mexico border. The Rio Grande was also a convenient barrier to cross when a certain American or Mexican law wasn't to your liking. Historian Omar Valerio Jimenez writes about the history of the Rio Grande Valley in his book, River of Hope, Forging Identity and Nation in the Rio Grande Borderlands. He says residents of the valley took advantage of those differences in laws regarding divorce, marriage, and even sexual abuse.
So in Mexico, because the Catholic Church governed marriage and divorce, if you had any kind of marital problems, you still had to approach a civil judge first, a civil authority. So if a woman was having problems with her husband because he was being abusive, physically abusive, or wasn't supporting her and her family financially, she would go to a judge, and that judge happened to be an alcalde. They had several alcaldes, several mayors. And they would go there, and then they would meet in this courts called courts of conciliation. And the courts of conciliation were basically meant, just like the word says, to try to resolve the issue, resolve the problem. They would have to have several meetings before the spouse who was complaining about the marriage could approach ecclesiastical authorities. But because of the existence of these courts of conciliation, if a woman was being abused physically, they would basically go to a court, mention what happened, and then these officials would try to prevent this from happening by bringing in the husband and saying, you know, you're charged with this. Well, on the U.S. side, after 1848, once the U.S. takes over, those courts of conciliation disappear. So you don't have that anymore. And so if a wife wanted to complain to a judge about her husband, she either had to complain, accuse the husband of some sort of crime, or she could seek a divorce. And so in some ways, Mexican courts, at least technically, had a little bit more power over trying to resolve marital disputes before it got to a divorce, right, than U.S. courts. But on another level, they had less, because if a wife was actually physically threatened, or if a woman in general was a victim of sexual assault or rape, in Mexico, it was difficult to have the assailant convicted. In the U.S., it was also difficult, and especially along the border, but I actually found some convictions of people actually being convicted for sexual assault in U.S. courts. But along both sides of the border, one of the things that made it difficult to convict men accused of sexual assault was the presence of the border itself. Because as soon as they were accused of something like that, they could just basically cross the border either into Mexico or from Mexico into Texas and escape prosecution. So this idea of sort of using the border to escape prosecution has also been around since the 19th century.
In your book, I had noticed towards the end, you write about sort of the attempts at the Americanization mm-hmm. of the population in the Lower Rio Grande Valley. And you were talking about the church earlier, and the church in the U.S., predominantly Protestant. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to establish churches, schools, to not just try to educate the populace, but also to try to convert them. Mm-hmm. And I think I still see this today where you may have a Catholic, Mexican, Hispanic family educating their children in a non-Catholic private school, but mm-hmm. yet they are still attending Catholic services. Sure. And that's kind of how it was back then as well.
Right, right. And there's historians who've actually studied this where it's sort of selective adaptation. So you have immigrants of all backgrounds. This has happened throughout the U.S., where immigrants are subject to Americanization programs, whether their language or religion or food or in, you know, the way they keep their house. And immigrant women and immigrant men will attend these programs or listen to them or whatever. That doesn't mean that they assimilate completely. They take what they believe is important. So, for example, learning English. Most immigrants are going to want their children to learn English if they intend to stay in the U.S. because they know that that's what's going to get them jobs, that's what's going to get them an education, right? But that doesn't mean that if they're Catholic or if they're Jewish, if they're Greek Orthodox, that doesn't mean that they're going to attend, like say, send their children to a religious school, a Protestant school, but that doesn't mean that they're going to stop being Greek Orthodox or Jewish or Catholic. It just means that they want their children to go to the best school possible to learn English, but they're going to selectively pick and choose what part of that Americanization program or assimilation program they want for their children. It's just like we do pick and choose, for instance, you know, off a menu, right? You pick and choose what parts of a new culture you adapt, and others you don't. So some children might get English language names, right, for a first name, but their middle name might still be a Spanish name. This is common. This has happened throughout history, but it's definitely happened in Texas in the 19th century as well.
So is there anything about the Lower Rio Grande Valley that kind of makes it an outlier in sort of the history of Texas or the history of colonization? I mean, because you obviously focused on this particular region mm-hmm. for a reason.
Right. So the Lower Rio Grande Valley is an outlier in the sense of the communities along the border, not complete outlier because there's a region in El Paso where this also happened. But when the U.S.-Mexico War occurred, there were a few communities along the new U.S.-Mexico boundary that were actually split in half. And in El Paso, that was the case. And most of the other parts along the U.S.-Mexico border, there were very few communities that lived right along the U.S.-Mexico boundary. But in the Lower Rio Grande Valley, that was definitely the case because the river attracted populations from both sides, right, and had attracted them since indigenous people lived there. And so you had places like Matamoros, like Laredo, that it existed before the U.S.-Mexico War. And as soon as the war is over, all of a sudden you have the development of what we call twin cities. So Matamoros is paired with Brownsville, which is the new town. Brownsville gets established right afterwards to promote trade, to promote, you know, social interactions and so forth. And you also have Laredo and Nuevo Laredo. So Nuevo Laredo is in Mexico, right? And it's the new Laredo because Laredo, Texas, was the old one, was the original town. And so you have more of these twin cities along the Lower Rio Grande Valley than other places along the U.S.-Mexico boundary, at least in the 19th century. And I would say even today, there's just a lot more populations there. And you have more interactions, I would say. When I went to school in California, many of the students who were there who were of Mexican background had never been to Mexico. When they did, they would cross into Tijuana, into Baja California, even though they had no relatives there, right? That was just because that was just the nearest place to cross. Whereas in the lower Rio Grande Valley, when people cross over, many times, not always, they're crossing over to visit their relatives. So those relational ties, those ties of ancestry are still there. One of the things I also try to remind students is that there's this saying, you know, among activists that we didn't cross the border crossed us. That's referring specifically to the U.S.-Mexican War. But it also is trying to push back on this idea that Mexicans are perennial immigrants and that are only immigrants. Well, as people here in San Antonio know, obviously, Mexicans have been here since before the U.S. was founded. And so Mexicans are both native-born and immigrants. And one of the things I like to mention and remind students is that the United States came to Mexicans. We didn't come to the United States. The United States came to Texas. They came to California. They came to Arizona and sort of annexed northern Mexico.
Omar Valerio Jimenez is an associate professor of history at the University of Texas at San Antonio. His book is River of Hope: Forging Identity and Nation in the Rio Grande Borderlands. You can hear part one of our conversation at tpr.org. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. Fernando Ortiz Jr. is our editor, and Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.